brush, twigs snapping underfoot. I was hoping the work crew had cleared a nice path for me, but they'd apparently been laboring farther down on the hill. I stumbled onto the fire lane, a packed dirt road just wide enough to admit one vehicle. I moved to the left, trying to calculate where the hotel was in relation to me. The whole backside of the building was apparently dark, and it was tricky to calculate my exact location. I risked the penlight. The shallow beam picked up an object looming in my path. I stopped dead. Ahead of me, nearly obscured by overhanging branches, was Shanna's battered Plymouth. Chapter 24. I circled the car, which looked vaguely sinister on the path, like the hulking carcass of some inexplicable beast. All four tires were flat. Someone hadn't wanted Shanna to go anywhere. I would almost have been willing to bet she was dead, that she'd arrived for her rendezvous with Dunn and had somehow never left. I lifted my head. The woods were chilly, smelling of leaf mold, damp mosses, and sulfur. The dark was intense, the night sounds eradicated, as if my very presence were a warning to the cicadas and tree frogs whose songs had been stilled. I didn't want to find her. I didn't want to look. Every bone in me was aching with the certainty that her body was here somewhere. I could feel my stomach churn as I flashed the narrow beam from the penlight across the front seat of Shanna's car. Nothing. I checked the back seat. Empty. I stared at the trunk lid. I didn't think my lockpicks would work, so if the trunk was locked, I was going to have to go down to the office, break in, lift Shanna's car keys from the lost and found box, and come back. I pressed the catch, and the trunk swung open. Empty. I let out the breath I'd been holding unconsciously. I left the lid up, not wanting to risk the noise I'd make slamming it shut. Sanctuary had to be somewhere close. I tried to picture the plot map for the spas in this area. I flashed the penlight across the close-growing shrubs, looking for a path. Foliage that appeared to be a vivid green by day now had the matte, washed-out look of construction paper. A set of packed dirt steps, shored up by railroad ties, descended through a gap in the bushes. I went down. A rustic wood arrow indicated that Erie was just off to my left. I passed Haven and Tip Top. Sanctuary was the fourth hot tub from the summit. I remembered then that it was located at the end of a long, twisted path, with two smaller paths branching off it. The leaves underfoot were soggy and made scarcely any sound, but I noticed I was leaving marshy prints in my wake. When I reached Sanctuary, I played the penlight across the ground. There were three cigarette butts trampled among the leaves. I hunkered down, bending close. Camel Unfiltered. Shanna's brand. The silence was undercut by the intermittent high whining of a siren out on the highway. An erratic breeze, as moist as the inside of an ice chest, rattled among the tree branches. With the strong odor from the mineral springs in the air, it was difficult to discern any other scent. I've been known to find bodies with my nose, but not in this case. The spa had a bifold insulated cover pulled over it, with a plastic handhold along the rim. I hesitated for a moment and then lifted it. A dense, sulphurous cloud wafted into my face. The water in the redwood tub was pitch black, as still as glass. Mist hovered on the surface. I could feel my mouth purse. I wasn't going to put my hand in there, folks. I wasn't going to plunge my arm in up to the elbow, feeling around to determine if Shanna's body was submerged in the depths. I experienced a nearly physical sensation of undulating hair, soft and feathery, at my fingertips. At the back of my mind, it did occur to me that if Shanna'd been killed and then dumped in here, she'd be floating by now, buoyed by accumulating gases, sort of like a pool toy. I could feel my eyes cross. Sometimes I sickened myself with my own thoughts. At knee height, there was a wooden door that apparently opened onto the heater and pump works tucked away out of sight. I pulled the door open. The body had been jammed in feet first. She unfolded from the waist, her bloody head coming to rest against my foot, sightless eyes staring up at me. A sound came up in my throat like bile.
"Don't move,"
I jumped, whipping around, a hand against my lurching heart. Elva Dunn was standing there, flashlight in her left hand. "Jesus, Elva, you scared the shit out of me," I snapped. She glanced briefly at Shanna, not nearly as startled by the sight as I had been. Belatedly, I noticed that she had a little .22 semi-automatic pointed at my gut. Gun buffs are dismissive of a .22, apparently convinced that a weapon doesn't count unless it's capable of blowing a fist-sized hole through a board. Unfortunately, Elva hadn't heard about this, and she looked as if she was ready to drill me a second belly button right above the first. Let a little .22 slug rip around in your gut and see how good you feel. It'll bounce off bone like a tiny bumper car, tearing up every organ in its path.
"I got a phone call from some guy who said Bailey Fowler was up here," she said. "Just stay where you are and don't move or I'll shoot."
I raised my hands like they do in the movies, thinking to reassure her.
"Hey, no Bailey. It's just me and I'm cool," I said. I gestured at Shanna's body. "I hope you don't think I did that."
"Bullshit, of course you did. Why else would you be here?"
I could hear the siren now and its winding approach on the road down below.
Somebody must have called the cops as well. "Mention Bailey's name and you got service real quick."
"Look, put the gun down. Honest to God, I saw Shanna's keys in the lost and found box this afternoon. I figured she must have been here at some point, so I thought I'd check it out."
"Where's the weapon? What did you do, hit her with a baseball bat?"
"Elva, she's been dead for days. She was probably killed Wednesday night. If I'd just done it, the blood would be bright red and, you know, spurting." I hate it when people can't comprehend the elementary stuff.
Elva's gaze jumped around, and she shifted nervously. Dr. Dunn had said she was a paranoid schizophrenic. But what does that mean? I thought all those people were tripping out on Thorazine these days, as placid as rocks. This woman was big, one of those ham-shouldered Nordic types. I already knew she was as weird as they come. If she'd whacked me with a Wilson, what was she going to do with a gun in her hand?
Two deputies with flashlights were zigzagging up the path from below. Things were not looking good. I let my eyes drift toward her pants and lifted my eyebrows a bit.
"Oh, wow. I wouldn't worry about it, but there's a spider the size of a meatball crawling down your leg." She had to look. How could she not? I kicked upward, my running shoe lifting the gun right out of her hand. I saw the .22 do a high, tumbling somersault and disappear into the dark. I rammed into her, knocking her ass over tea kettle right after it. She yelped as she tumbled backward, crashing down the hill. The first of the deputies had apparently reached the midpoint of the hill. I shoved my penlight in my pocket and ran like hell. I wasn't sure where I was going, but I hoped to get there quick. I angled up through the trees, headed for the fire lane, figuring I could run for a while unimpeded. Shanna's Plymouth was blocking the overgrown lane, so even if they managed to get a sheriff's car up here, they'd have trouble getting through. I was making too much noise to hear if anyone was behind me, but it seemed smarter to assume the cops were close on my heels. I quickened my pace, sailing over the trunk of a tree in my path. The fire lane began to climb steeply, dead-ending in a gate with a wire fence that stretched away on either side. I took a flying leap, put a hand on the gatepost, and arched my back, catching my foot as I tried to clear the top. I smacked down with an oof, rolled, and got up again, suppressing a moan. The fall had rammed the Davis right into my ribs. Much pain. I plugged on, heading upward. The hill leveled out in a rugged pasture dotted with scrub oak and manzanita. The moon wasn't full, but there was enough of it to illuminate the choppy field through which I ran. I must have been a quarter of a mile from the road, in an area inaccessible to vehicles. I was desperately in need of rest. I looked over my shoulder. There was no sign of pursuit. I slowed to a jog and searched out a depression in the grass. I sank down, winded, blotting my sweaty brow on the sleeve of my turtleneck. Some winged creature swooped down close to me and then cruised away, temporarily mistaking me for something edible. I hate nature. I really do. Nature is composed entirely of sticks, dirt, fall-down places, biting and stinging things, and savageries too numerous to list. And I'm not the only one who feels this way. Man has been building cities since the year aughty-aught just to get away from this stuff. Now we're on our way to the moon and other barren spots where nothing grows and you can pick up a rock without having something jump out at you. The quicker we get there, the better as far as I'm concerned.
Time to move. I staggered to my feet again and began to trot, wishing I had a plan. I couldn't go back to the motel. The sheriff's department was going to be there in 10 minutes flat. But without my car keys and some bucks, what was I going to do? It occurred to me I might have been better off hanging out with Elva until the deputies arrived, taking my chances with the law. Now I was a fugitive, and I didn't like it much. A flash of Shanna's face popped into my head. She'd been bludgeoned to death, from the look of her, shoved into the narrow space under the hot tub until someone could dispose of her, if that was the intent. Maybe that's what Elva had trudged up there in the dark to do. I couldn't decide if I should believe her claim about the phone call. Had she killed Shanna Timberlake? Killed her daughter 17 years before that? Why the lag time? And why Ori Fowler? Given Elva as the killer, I couldn't come up with a scenario in which Ori's death made any sense. Could the phone call have been meant to trap me up there? As far as I knew, the only two people who were aware of where I'd be were Jack Clempson and Bert. I halted again. The ground was beginning to slant downward, and I found myself squinting through the dark at a sharp drop-off. Below, a gray ribbon of road curled along the base of the hill. I had no idea where it led, but if the cops were smart, they'd be calling for backup cars, which might be cruising by any minute, hoping to cut me off. I scrambled down the rocky incline as fast as I could, half-humping, half-sliding on my backside, preceded by a tiny landslide of loose stones and dirt. I could hear approaching sirens as I skidded the last few feet. I was panting from exhaustion, but I didn't dare stop. I hightailed it across the road, reaching the far side just as the first black and white rounded the bend, maybe 600 yards away. I plunged into the brush, hugging the ground as I belly-crawled my way through the weeds. Once I was safely in the cover of the trees, I paused to reorient myself, rolling over on my back. Against the encroaching fog bank, I could see the reflection of the vapor lights that lined Ocean Street. Floral Beach wasn't far. Unfortunately, what lay between me and the town was the posted property belonging to the oil refinery. I studied the 8-foot chain-link fence. Strands of barbed wire were strung along the top. No crossing that. Big oil storage tanks loomed up on the far side, painted in pastel shades like a series of cakes. I was still close enough to the road that I could hear the squawking of the sheriff's cars in position along the berm. Lights raked the hillside. I hoped the suckers hadn't brought dogs. That was all I'd need. I crawled to the base of the fence, clinging to it doggedly as I pushed on. In the dark, it served not only as a guide, but as a needed support. More warning signs. This was a hard hat area, and me with no hard hat. I was winded and sweating, my hands torn, nose beginning to run. The smell of the ocean was getting stronger, and I took comfort from that. Abruptly, the fence took a hard cut left. What opened up in front of me was a dirt path strewn with trash. A lover's lane, perhaps. I didn't dare use my penlight. I was still in the hills above Floral Beach, but I was getting closer to the town. In less than a quarter of a mile, I found myself at the tag end of the lane that spilled into a cul-de-sac. Oh, glory, now I knew where I was. This was the bluff above Jean Timberlake's old apartment building. Once I reached the wooden stairway, I could climb down to the rear door of her place and hide. To my right, I spotted the glass and frame house where I'd knocked earlier. Lights were on inside. I skirted the house, groping my way along the property line, marked by waist-high shrubs. As I passed the kitchen window, I caught sight of the occupant looking straight out at me. I dropped, realizing belatedly that the guy must be standing at the kitchen sink. The window would be throwing his own reflection back at him, effectively blocking out the sight of me, I hoped. Cautiously, I rose and peered closer. Dwight Shales. I blinked, debating with myself. Could I trust him? Was I safer up here with him or hiding in the abandoned building below? Oh, hell, this was no time to be shy. I needed help. I doubled back to the front porch and rang the bell. I kept an eye on the street, worried a patrol car would cruise into sight. At some point, they were going to realize I'd slipped through the net. Given the impenetrability of the oil company property, this was probably the logical place to end up. The porch light came on. The front door opened. I turned to look at him.
Kinsey, my God, what happened to you?
Hello, Dwight. Can I come in? He held the door open, stepping back.
Are you in some kind of trouble?
That would cover it, I said. My explanation was worthy of a box top, 25 words or less, tendered while I followed him through the foyer, all raw woods and modern art. We went down a step into the living room, which was dead ahead, two stories of glass looking out toward the view. The roof of Jean's apartment building wasn't visible, but I could see the lights of Floral Beach stretching almost as far as the big hotel on the hillside half a mile away.
Let me get you a drink, he said.
Thanks. Do you mind if I clean up? He nodded to his left.
Straight down the hall.
I found the bathroom and ran some water, scrubbing my hands and face. I blotted my face dry, staring at myself in the bathroom mirror. I had a big scratch on my cheek. My hair was matted with dirt. I found a comb in his medicine cabinet and ran it through my mop. I peed, brushed myself off, washed my hands and face again, and returned to the living room, where Dwight handed me some brandy in a softball-sized snifter. I took it neat, and he poured me a second.
Thanks, I said. I could feel the liquor defining my insides as it eased through.
I had to breathe with my mouth open for a bit.
Phew! Great! Sit down. You look beat.
I am, I said. I glanced anxiously toward the front door. Are we visible from the street? The narrow panels on either side of the front door were frosted glass. It was the exposed living room that bothered me. I felt as if I were on stage. He crossed the room and closed the drapes. The room was suddenly much cozier, and I relaxed a bit. He sat down in the chair across from me.
Tell me again.
I went back through the story, filling in the details. I probably should have just waited for the cops.
You want to go ahead and call them and turn yourself in? The phone's right there.
Not yet, I said. That's what I kept telling Bailey, but now I know how he felt. They'd just keep me up all night, hounding me with questions I don't have the answers for.
What are you going to do?
Don't know. Get my head together and see if I can figure this out. You know, I was up here earlier and knocked on the door, but you weren't home. I wanted to ask if anybody up here ever saw Jean using the stairs.
The stairs?
Up from the Timberlake's apartment. It was right down there. I found myself pointing to the floor to indicate the base of the bluff.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten about that. Talk about small towns. I guess none of us are that far from anybody else.
That's for sure, I said. At the back of my mind, uneasiness was beginning to stir. Something about his response wasn't quite ringing true. Maybe it was his manner, which was suddenly too studiously casual to be believable. Pretending to be normal is a lot harder than you'd think. Did it mean anything, his having lived this close? You forgot Jean Timberlake lived 30 feet away?
No big deal, he said. I think they only lived there a few months before she died.
He set his brandy snifter on the coffee table.
You hungry? I'd be happy to fix you something to eat.
I shook my head, easing him back toward the subject that interested me. I realized this afternoon that the back door of the Timberlake apartment opened right onto the stairs. I figure she could easily have used the road up here as a rendezvous point for the guys she screwed around with. You never saw her up here? He considered the possibility, searching his memory.
No, I don't believe so. Is it that important?
Well, it could be. If somebody saw Jean, they might also have seen the guy she was having the affair with.
Come to think of it, I did see cars up here at night on occasion. I guess it never occurred to me it might be somebody waiting to pick her up.
I love bad liars. They work so hard at it, and the effort is so transparent. I happen to lie well myself, but only after years of practice. Even then, I can't pull it off every time. This guy didn't even come close. I sat and looked at him, giving him time to reconsider his position. He frowned with concern.
By the way, what's the story on Anne's mother? Mrs. Emma called about an hour ago and told me Bailey switched the medication. I couldn't believe it.
Excuse me, could we get back to Jean Timberlake first?
Oh, sorry. I thought we were done, and I've been awfully worried about Anne. It's unbelievable what she's been through. Anyway, go ahead.
Were you fucking Jean Timberlake yourself?
The word was just right, crude and to the point. He let out a little laugh of disbelief, like he must not have heard me right.
What?
Come on, fess up. Just tell me the truth. I'd really like to know.
He laughed again, shaking his head as though to clear it.
My God, Kinsey, I'm a high school principal.
I know what you are, Dwight. I'm asking you what you did.
He stared at me, apparently annoyed that I'd persist.
This is ridiculous. The girl was 17.
I said nothing. I returned a look of such skepticism that his smile began to fade. He got up and poured himself another drink. He held the brandy bottle toward me, mutely asking me if I wanted more. I shook my head. He sat down again.
I think we should move on to something more productive. I'm willing to help, but I'm not going to play any games with you.
He was all business now. The meeting was called to order, and we were going to get serious. No more silly bullshit.
I'd have to be crazy to get involved with a student, he went on. Jesus, what an idea!
He rolled his shoulders. I could hear the joint pop. I knew he wanted to convince me, but the words carried no conviction. I dropped my gaze to the tabletop, pushing my empty snifter an inch.
We're all capable of astonishing ourselves when it comes to sex.
He was silent. I focused on him intently. He recrossed his legs.
Now it was him, not looking at me.
Dwight?
He said,
I thought I was in love with her.
Careful, I thought. Take care.
The moment is fragile, and his trust is tenuous.
It must have been a tough time. Karen was diagnosed with MS right about then, wasn't she?
He set the glass down again, and his gaze met mine.
You have a good memory.
I kept silent. He finally took up the narrative thread.
She was actually in the process of being evaluated, but I think we knew. It's staggering how something like that affects you. She was bitter at first, withdrawn. In the end, she was better about it than I was. God, I couldn't believe it was happening. And then I turned around and Jean was there. Young, lusty, outrageous.
He was quiet for a moment. I said nothing, letting him tell it his way. He didn't need any prompting from me. This was a story he knew by heart.
I didn't think Karen would survive anyway because the first round was acute. She seemed to go downhill overnight. Hell, I didn't think she'd live till spring. In a situation like that, your mind leaps ahead. You get into survival mode. I remember thinking, hey, I can make it. The marriage isn't that great anyway. I was only, what, 39, 40? I had a lot of years ahead of me. I figured I'd marry again. Why not? We weren't perfect, the two of us. I'm not sure we were even very well suited to each other. The MS changed all that. When she died, I was more in love with her than I'd ever been.
And Jean?
Ah, but Jean. Early on,
he paused to shake his head.
I was crazy. I must have been. If that relationship had ever become public knowledge, well, it would have ruined my life. Karen's too, what was left of it.
Was the baby yours?
I don't know. Probably. I wish I could say no, but what could I do? I only found out about it after Jean died. I can't imagine what the consequences would have been, you know, if the pregnancy had come to light.
Yeah, unlawful sexual intercourse being what it is.
Oh, God, don't say that. Even now the phrase is enough to make me sick.
You kill her?
No,
I swear. I was capable of a lot of craziness back then, but not that.
I watched him, sensing that he was telling the truth. This wasn't a killer I was listening to. He might have been desperate or despairing. He might have realized after the fact how perilous his situation was, but I didn't hear the kind of rationalization killers get into.
Who else knew about the pregnancy?
I don't know. What difference would it make?
I'm not sure. You can't really be certain the baby was yours. Maybe there was somebody else.
Bailey knew about it.
Aside from him, couldn't someone else have heard?
Well, sure, but so what?
I know she showed up at the school very upset and went straight to the counselor's office.
I thought the guidance counselors only handled academic matters, college prep requirements, and stuff like that.
There were exceptions. Sometimes we had to screen personal problems and refer kids out for professional counseling.
What would have been done then if Jean had asked for help?
We'd have done what we could. San Luis has social agencies set up for things like that.
Jean never talked to you herself.
He shook his head.
I wish she had.
Maybe I could have done something for her, I don't know. She had her crazy side. We're not talking about a girl who'd agree to an abortion. She never would have given that baby up, and she wouldn't have kept quiet. She'd have insisted on marriage regardless of the price. I have to tell you, I know it sounds horrible, but I have to say this. I was relieved when she died, enormously. When I understood the risk I'd taken, when I saw what I had at stake, it was a gift. I cleaned up my act right then. I never screwed around on Karen again.
I believe you, I said.
But what was bothering me? I could feel an idea churning, but I couldn't quite sense what it was.
Dwight was going on. It was a bit of a rude awakening when I heard the stories going around after she'd been killed. I was naive enough to think we had something special between us, but that turned out not to be the case.
I kept picking at it like a bone. So if she didn't turn to you for help, she could have turned to somebody else.
Well, yes, but she didn't have much time for that, as I understand. She had the test done in Lompoc and got the results that afternoon. By midnight, she was dead.
How long does it take to make a phone call, I said.
She had hours. She could have called half the guys in Floral Beach and some in San Luis, too.
Suppose it was someone else. Suppose you were just a cover for another relationship. There must have been other guys with just as much to lose.
I'm sure it's possible, he said, but he sounded dubious.
The phone rang, a harsh sound in the stillness of the big house.
Dwight leaned back, reaching over to pick up the receiver from the end table by the couch.
Hello? Oh, hi.
His face had brightened with recognition, and I saw his eyes stray to my face as the person on the other end of the line went on. He was making, noises while someone rattled on.
No, don't worry. Hang on, she's right here.
He held the phone out, and I took it.
It's Anne, he said.
Hi, Anne, what's happening?
Her voice was cold, and she was clearly upset.
Well, at long last, where the hell have you been? I've been looking for you for hours.
I found myself squinting at the phone, trying to determine the reason for the tone she had taken. What was wrong with her?
Is there a deputy with you, I asked.
I think we could say that.
You want to wait and call me back when he goes?
No, I don't, dear. Here's what I want. I want you to get your ass down here right away. Daddy checked himself out of the hospital, and he's been bugging me ever since.
Where have you been? She shrieked. Do you have any idea?
Do you have any idea what's been going on? Do you? God damn it!
I held the phone away from my ear. She was really building up a head of steam here.
Anne, stop that. Calm down. It's too complicated to go into right now.
Don't give me that. Don't you dare ever, ever give me that.
Don't give you what? What are you so upset about?
You know perfectly well, she snapped. What are you doing over there? You listen to me, Kinsey, and you listen good.
I started to interrupt, but she just put a palm across the mouthpiece, talking to someone in the background.
The deputy?
Oh, hell, was she telling him where I was?
I replaced the receiver in the cradle. Dwight was looking at me with perplexity.
You okay? What was that about?
I have to go to San Luis Obispo, I said carefully.
It was a lie, of course, but it was the first thing that occurred to me. Anne had told them where I was.
Within minutes, this whole cul-de-sac would be blocked off, the neighborhood swarming with deputies. I had to get out of there, and I didn't think it was wise to let him know where I was headed.
San Luis, he said. What for?
I moved toward the front door.
Don't worry about it. I'll be back in a bit. Don't you need a car?
I'll get one. I closed the door behind me, leaped off the porch, and ran.
Chapter 25. The Last Chapter.
The Ocean Street Motel was only four blocks away. It wasn't going to take the cops long. I kept to the pavement until I caught the sound of a vehicle accelerating up the hill. I took a dive into the bushes as a black and white sped into view, heading straight for Dwight's place. Lights flashing, no siren.
A second black and white gunned up the hill after the first. Hot doggers. The deputy in the second car was probably 22. Big career ahead of him, careening through Floral Beach legally. He must have been having the time of his life. The solution to so many problems seems obvious once you know where to look. My conversation with Dwight had generated a shift in my mindset, and the questions that had troubled me before now seemed to have answers that made perfect sense. Some of them, at any rate. I needed confirmation, but at least now I had a working premise. Jean Timberlake had been murdered to protect Dwight Shales. Ori Fowler had died because she was meant to die, to get her out of the way. And Shanna? I thought I understood why she had died, too. Bailey was supposed to take the rap for all of it, and he'd fallen for it like a chump. If he'd had sense enough not to run, if he'd just stayed put, he couldn't have been blamed for everything that had happened since. I approached the motel from the rear, through a vacant lot filled with weeds and broken glass. Many of the motel windows were ablaze with lights. I could imagine all the uproar caused by the presence of sheriff's cars. I suspected there was still a deputy posted somewhere close, probably just outside my room. I reached the Fowler's back door. The kitchen light was on, and I could see the shadow of someone moving around in the back part of the apartment. A little black-and-white television now sat on the counter, a taped newscast flickering across the empty room. Quintana was making mouth noises on the courthouse steps. Must have been this afternoon. A picture of Bailey Fowler followed. He was being led in handcuffs to a waiting vehicle. On came the announcer, turning to the weather map. I tried the kitchen door. Locked. I didn't want to stand out there trying to pick the lock. I circled the building, hugging the outside wall, checking darkened windows for one left ajar. What I found instead was a side door that was located just across from the stairway inside the back hall. The knob turned in my hand, and I pushed the door open cautiously. I peered in. Royce, in a ratty bathrobe, was shuffling down the hall toward me, slump-shouldered, eyes on his slippers. I could hear the hum of his weeping, broken by intermittent sighs. He was walking his grief like a baby back and forth. He reached the door to his room and turned, shuffling back toward the kitchen. Now and then he murmured Ori's name, voice breaking off. Lucky is the spouse who dies first, who never has to know what survivors endure. Royce must have signed himself out of the hospital after Reverend Hawes paid his call. Ori's death had pushed him past struggling. What did he care if he sped death along? The lights from the living room gave the uncomfortable sense of other people very near. I could hear two women in the dining room talking in low tones. Was Mrs. Emma still with Anne? Royce was reaching the kitchen, where I knew he'd turn again, coming back. I closed the door behind me, crossed to the stairs, and took them two at a time, moving silently. I should have put two and two together when I saw that the maid's master key wouldn't open room 20. That room had probably been sealed off, part of the Fowler's apartment upstairs. The second floor was dark, except for a window on the landing through which a soft yellow light now spilled. I was disoriented. Somehow this didn't look the way I'd expected it to. There was a short corridor to my left, ending in a door. I crossed to it, stopped, and listened carefully. Silence. I tried the knob and pushed the door open a crack. Cold air wafted in. I was facing the exterior corridor that ran right by my room. I could see the vending machine and the outside stairs. To my immediate left was room 20, next to that room 22 where I'd spent my first night. There was no sign of a deputy on duty. Did I dare simply mosey down, use my key, and go in? What if the deputy was waiting inside? I reached around and tried the knob from the outside. Ah, locked. Once I went out this door, I couldn't get back in unless I jammed it open. I stayed where I was, easing the door shut. The door to my left was unlocked. I slipped inside, taking out my penlight. Like the rest of the Fowler's living quarters, this had once been a regular motel room, converted now to office space. Sliding glass doors along the front opened onto a second-floor balcony overlooking Ocean Street. The drapes were open, and I could make out a desk, a swivel chair, bookcases, a reading lamp. I swept the room with the narrow beam of the penlight, getting my bearings. The book titles were half-fiction, half-college textbooks in psychology. Anne's.
On the desk was a photo of Ori in her youth. She really had been beautiful, with large, luminous eyes. I searched the desk drawers, nothing of interest. Checked the closet alcove, which was filled with summer clothing. The bathroom held nothing. The door that connected this room to room 20 was locked. Locked doors are always more interesting than the other kind. This time I got out my set of key picks and set to work. In TV shows, people pick locks with remarkable ease. Not so in real life, where you have to have the patience of a saint. I was working in the dark, clamping the penlight in my mouth like a cigar while I used the rocker pick in my left hand and the wire in my right. Sometimes I do this efficiently, but that's usually when the light is good. This time it took forever, and I was sweating from the tension when the lock finally gave. Room 20 was a duplicate of the one I'd occupied. This was Anne's bedroom, the one Maxine was not to clean. I could see why. On the closet floor, dead ahead, was a Ponsonous Warren shot-shell reloader with a built-in wad guide, an adjustable crimp die, and two powder reservoirs filled with rock salt. I crossed to the closet and hunkered down, inspecting the device, which looks like a cross between a bird feeder and a cappuccino machine, and is designed to pack a shell with anything you like. A blast of rock salt at close range usually ends up buried under your skin where it stings like a son of a bitch, but doesn't do much else. Tap had found out just how ineffectual salt can be in staving off the sheriff's deputies. I had really hit the jackpot. On the floor beside the reloader was a microcassette recorder with a tape in it. I pressed the rewind button and then pressed play, listening to a familiar voice slowed down to a series of quite nasty gravel-throated threats. I rewound, switched the tape speed, and tried it again. The voice was clearly Anne's, spelling out her intentions with an axe and a chainsaw. The whole thing sounded stupid, but she must have had a ball.
"I am going to get you."
We used to do shit like this as kids.
"I am going to cut your head off."
I smiled grimly, remembering the night those calls had come through. I'd taken comfort from the fact that someone two doors away was wide awake like me. The square of light had looked so cozy at that hour. All the time she'd been in here, dialing room to room, part of her campaign of psychological abuse. At this point, I couldn't even remember when I'd had an uninterrupted night's sleep. I was being carried on adrenaline and nerve, the momentum of events sweeping me willy-nilly down the path. The night my room was broken into, all she'd had to do was use her passkey and jimmy up the sliding glass door afterward so it would look like the point of entry. I got to my feet and checked the shelf above. In a shoebox, I found a windowed envelope addressed to Erica Dahl, containing quarterly dividends and year-end tax summaries for IBM stock. There must have been more than 100 such envelopes neatly packed into the box, along with a Social Security card, driver's license, and passport, with Anne Fowler's photograph affixed. The statements from Merrill Lynch showed a $42,000 investment in shares of IBM back in 1967. With stock splits in the intervening years, the shares had more than doubled in value. I noticed that Erica had dutifully paid taxes on the interest that accrued from year to year. Anne Fowler was too shrewd to get tripped up by the IRS. I flashed the penlight through her living room and kitchenette, doing a 180 turn. When the narrow beam crossed the bedstead, I caught an oval of white and flashed the light back over it again. Anne was propped up in bed, watching me. Her face was dead pale, her eyes enormous, so filled with lunacy and hate that my skin crawled. I felt as if I'd been pierced with an icy arrow, the chill spreading from the core of my body to my fingertips. In her lap, she held a double-barreled shotgun, which she raised and pointed right at my chest. Probably not rock salt. I didn't think the spider story was going to work with her.
"Finding everything you need?" she asked.
I raised my hands just to show I knew how to behave. "Hey, you're pretty good. You almost got away with it." Her smile was thin.
"Now that you're wanted, I can do it, don't you think?" she said conversationally. "All I have to do is pull the trigger and claim trespass."
"And then what?"
"You tell me."
I hadn't quite worked the whole story out, but I knew enough to make a flying guess. Why you have chats with killers in circumstances like these is because you hope against hope you can, 1, talk them out of it, 2, stall until help arrives, or 3, enjoy a few more moments of this precious commodity we call life, which consists in large part of breathing in and out.
Hard to do with your lungs blown out your back.
Well, said I, hoping to make a short story long, I figure once your daddy dies and you unload this place, you'll take the proceeds, add them to the profits from the 42 thou you stole, and sail off into the sunset, possibly with Dwight Shales, or so you hope.
And why not?
Why not indeed? Sounds like a great plan. Does he know about it yet?
He will, she said.
What makes you think he'll agree?
Why wouldn't he? He's free now, and I will be too, as soon as Pop dies.
And you think that constitutes a relationship? I said, astonished.
What do you know about relationships?
Hey, I've been married twice. That's more than you can say.
You're divorced. You don't know Dick.
I had to shrug at that. I bet Jean was sorry she confided in you.
Very. At the end, she put up quite a fight.
But you won.
I had to. I couldn't have her ruining Dwight's life.
Assuming it was his, I said.
The babe? Of course it was.
Oh, great. No problem, then. You're completely justified, I said. Does he know how much you've done for him?
That's our little secret, yours and mine.
How did you know where Shanna would be Wednesday night?
Simple. I followed her.
But why kill the woman?
Same reason I'm going to kill you. For screwing Dwight.
She was going up there to meet Joe Dunn, I said. Neither one of us screwed Dwight.
Bullshit!
It's not bullshit. He's a nice enough guy, but he's not my type. He told me himself he and Shanna were just friends. It was strictly platonic. They hadn't even screwed once.
You liar! You think I don't know what's been going on? You sashay into town and start coming on to him, riding around in his car, having cozy dinners.
And we were talking, that's all it was.
Nobody's going to get in my way, Kinsey. Not after all I've been through. I've worked too hard and waited too long. I've sacrificed my entire adult life, and you're not going to spoil things now that I'm almost free.
Well, listen, Anne. If I may say so, you're as crazy as a bug. No offense, but you are Looney Tunes. Completely cuckoo nuts. I was just making mouth noises while I thought about my gun. My little Davis was still in the holster, tucked up against my left breast. What I wanted to do was take it out and plug her right between the eyes. Or someplace fatal. But here's the way I figured it. By the time I reached up under my turtleneck, snatched the gun out, pointed it, and fired, the shotgun of hers would have taken off my face. And how was I going to get the gun? Feign a heart attack? I didn't think she'd fall for it. My eyes had adjusted to the dark, and since I could see her perfectly, I had to guess she could see me just as well. Mind if I turn off the penlight? I hate to use up the batteries, I said. The beam was pointed at the ceiling, and my arms were getting tired. Probably hers, too. A shotgun like that weighs a good 7 pounds. Not easy to hold steady, even if you're used to lifting weights.
Just stay where you are and don't move.
Wow, that's just what Elva said. Anne reached over and turned on the bedside lamp. She looked worse in the light. She had a mean face, I could see that now. The slightly receding chin made her look like a rat. The shotgun was a 12-gauge, over and under, and she seemed to know which end did the hurt. Dimly I became aware of a shuffling sound in the hall. Royce. When had he come upstairs?
Anne? Ah, Annie, I found some pictures of your mother I thought you'd like. Can I come in?
I saw her eyes flick toward the door.
I'll be down in a minute, Pop. We can look at them then.
Too late. He had pushed the door open, peering in. He had a photograph album in his arms, and his face held such innocence. His eyes seemed very blue. His lashes were sparse, still wet from his tears, his nose red. Gone was the gruffness, the arrogance, the dominance. His illness had made him frail, and Dory's death had knocked him to his knees. But here he came again, an old man full of hope.
Mrs. Maud and Mrs. Emma are looking for you to say good night.
I'm busy right now. Will you take care of it?
He caught sight of me. He must have wondered what I was doing with my hands in the air. His attention strayed to the shotgun and held at shoulder height. I thought he was going to turn and shuffle out again. He hesitated, uncertain what to do next. I said, "Hello, Royce. Guess who killed Jean Timberlake?" He glanced at me and then looked away.
"Well..."
His gaze slid over to Anne as if she might deny the accusation. She got up from the bed and reached behind him for the door. "Go on downstairs, Pop. I have something to do and then I'll be down." He seemed confused.
"You're not going to hurt her?"
"No, of course not," she said. "She's going to shoot my ass," I said. His gaze strayed back to hers, looking for reassurance. "What do you think she's doing with that shotgun? She's going to kill me dead and then claim trespass. She told me so." "Pops, I caught her going through my closet. The cops are after her. She's in cahoots with Bailey, trying to help him get away." "Oh, don't be a silly. Why would I do that?"
"Bailey?" Roy said.
It was the first time tonight I'd seen comprehension in his eyes. "Royce, I've got proof he's innocent. Anne's the one who killed Jean."
"You liar,"
Anne cut in.
"The two of you are trying to take Pop for everything he's worth."
God, I couldn't believe this. Anne and I were squabbling like little kids, each of us trying to persuade Royce to be on our side. "Did too, did not, did too." Royce put a trembling finger to his lips.
"If she's got proof, maybe we should hear what it is," he said, talking almost to himself. "Don't you think so, Annie? If she can prove Bailey's innocent?"
I could see the rage begin to stir at the mention of his name. I was worried she would shoot and argue with her daddy afterward. The same thought apparently occurred to him. He reached for the shotgun.
"Put it down, baby."
Abruptly, she backed away.
"Don't touch me!"
I could feel my heart start to thud, afraid he'd yield. Instead, he seemed to focus, gathering his strength.
"What are you doing, Anne? You can't do that."
"Go on, get out of here."
"I want to hear what Kinsey has to say."
"Just do what I tell you and get the hell out."
He clapped a hand on the barrel.
"Give me that before you hurt someone."
"No."
Anne snatched it out of his reach. Royce lunged, grabbing it. The two of them struggled for possession of the shotgun. I was immobilized, my attention fixed on the big black eight of the two barrels that pointed first at me, then the floor, ceiling, weaving through the air. Royce should have been the stronger, but illness had sapped him, and Anne's rage gave her the edge. Royce jerked the gun by the stock. Fire spurted from the barrel, and the blast filled the room with powder smell. The shotgun thumped to the floor as Anne screamed. She was looking down in disbelief. Most of her right foot had been blown away. All that was left was a torn stump of raw meat. I could feel heat rip through me as though the sensation were mine. I turned away, repelled. The pain must have been excruciating, blood pumping out. What color she had left drained from her face. She sank to the floor, speechless, her body rocking as she clutched herself. Her cries dropped to a low, relentless pitch. Royce backed away from her, his voice feeble with regret.
"I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that. I tried to help."
I could hear people pounding up the stairs.
"Bert, Mrs. Maud,
a young deputy I'd never seen."
"Another kid. Wait until he got a load of this."
"Get an ambulance," I yelled.
I was pulling a pillowcase off the bed, wadding it against her mangled foot, trying to stanch the blood spewing everywhere. The deputy fumbled with his walkie-talkie while Mrs. Maud babbled, wringing her hands. Mrs. Emma had pushed into the room behind her, and she began to shriek when she saw what was going on. Maxine and Bert were both white-faced, holding on to each other. Belatedly, the deputy herded all of them into the corridor and closed the door again. Even through the wall, I could hear Mrs. Emma's shrill cries. Anne was lying on her back by then, one arm flung across her face. Royce clung to her right hand, rocking back and forth. She was weeping like a 5-year-old.
"You were never there for me. You were never there."
I thought about my papa. I was 5 when he left me. 5 when he went away. An image came to me, a memory repressed for years. In the car, just after the wreck, when I was trapped in the back seat, wedged in tight, with the sound of my mother's weeping going on and on and on.
I had reached around the edge of the front seat where I found my father's hand, unresisting, passive, and soft. I tucked my fingers around his, not understanding he was dead, simply thinking everything would be all right as long as I had him. When had it dawned on me that he was gone for good? When had it dawned on Anne that Royce was never going to come through? And what of Jean Timberlake? None of us had survived the wounds our fathers inflicted all those years ago. Did he love us? How would we ever know? He was gone, and he'd never again be what he was to us in all his haunting perfection. If love is what injures us, how can we heal? Epilogue. The case against Bailey Fowler has been dismissed. He turned himself in when he heard news of Anne's arrest. She was charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Ori Fowler and Shanna Timberlake. The DA's office may never be able to assemble sufficient evidence to prosecute her for the death of Jean Timberlake. 2 weeks have passed. I'm now back in my office in Santa Teresa, where I've itemized expenses. With the hours I put in, my mileage and meals, I'm billing Royce Fowler for $1,832, against the $2,000 he advanced. We chatted about it by phone, and he's told me to keep the change. He's still hanging on to life with all the stubbornness he can muster, and at least Bailey will be with him during his last weeks. I find that I'm looking at Henry Pitts differently these days. He may be the closest thing to a father I'll ever have. Instead of viewing him with suspicion, I think I'll enjoy him for the time we have left, whatever that may be. He's only 82, and God knows, my life is more hazardous than his. Respectfully submitted, Kinsey Milhone. This concludes the reading of F is for Fugitive by Sue Grafton. This book was read by Mary Pfeiffer.